In just a brief span of time, the weather had shifted from warm to a bitter, freezing cold. The water was still. It was so still that you couldn't tell where the ocean ended and the thick blanket of stars began. The air was clear, as far as the horizon, not a cloud in the sky. It seemed like perfect visibility for Frederick Fleet and Reginald Lee, the two men who sat as lookouts in the crow's nest, entrusted with the safety of the 2,200 souls on board the Titanic. April 14th, 1912, 11:30 p.m. It was day five of the Titanic's maiden voyage. The world's largest ship steamed full speed through a massive ice field in the darkness, confident that her lookouts could provide at least 30 minutes of warning of any danger that lay in her path. 10 minutes later, that confidence was fatally shattered. The iceberg the lookout spotted wasn't 30 minutes away. No, when the three sharp rings of the warning bell sounded, the ship's crew only had about 30 seconds warning before impact. Something had gone terribly wrong. The crew reacted immediately, throwing the engines into reverse and turning the wheel hard over starboard. And despite her size, the Titanic was highly maneuverable, so instead of slamming straight into the iceberg head-on, she managed to begin turning away, but not fast enough. Before, below the waterline, the ice ripped into her hull, opening up a 300-foot gash in the 1-inch-thick steel plating. Even in the event of a disaster, the Titanic was believed to be unsinkable. You know, it was built to stay afloat under virtually any accident scenario that the engineers could think of. The worst-case scenario that they had thought of, and that they could imagine, was a collision that would flood two of the airtight compartments. And despite this belief, the ship was over-engineered beyond this so that it could even float if first four compartments had been flooded within the ship. The captain himself is recorded as telling his dinner guests the very night of the incident how the ship could have been cut crosswise into three separate pieces, and each individual piece would have floated all on its own. But the sideswipe disaster that flooded six of Titanic's watertight compartments, an event that was considered statistically impossible and has never happened since or prior to that in maritime recorded history, ended up sinking the ship. In a moment, sudden disaster struck Titanic in the night. And 4 hours later, the ship sunk beneath the waves of the Labrador Sea. Somehow, both lookouts had failed to see the iceberg standing in their path. Couldn't see it until it was nearly on top of them. They'd been able to discern what was about to occur because they didn't recognize the danger signs. Multiple eyewitnesses saw these signs, but no one realized what they were or what they meant. And so the ship continued on its course of destruction without realizing that anything was amiss. Let's turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. First Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 1. But concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you. But you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them, as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape. Brethren, how quickly could the end of the age come upon this world? How quickly might the great tribulation be approaching through the haze of the future? Are we 100 years away? 50? 20? 10? Even less? Let me put your mind at ease. I won't be throwing out any dates for Christ's return today. Now, Jesus made it clear that we can't pinpoint the exact timing of the end of the world and his return, as he said in Mark 13:32, but of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven or the Son, but only the Father. However, we can and should have a good idea of where we are in the order of prophesied events, so that we're able to recognize the signs of the end times and watch for the prophetic events that surround it, and therefore know when the season is upon us. Let's turn to Matthew 24, and we'll start in verse 32. Matthew 24, 32. Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near, at the doors. In other words, when we see the prophecies Jesus had described in what is called the Olivet Prophecy coming to pass, we can know the end of this evil age is approaching, that it is truly near. Further down in Matthew 24, Jesus stressed the importance of watching and always being ready, because some end time events can happen suddenly, you know, at an hour that we do not expect, as it says in verse 44. Christ warns us to watch for the signs of the end and expects us to recognize when the end is near. So today I'd like to examine some of these signs, seven of these signs or prophetic events of the end times. And based on current world events, ask ourselves, how quickly could these things occur? How quickly could these seven signs of the end time occur? And I'll just reiterate again, we're not trying to determine when these signs will be fulfilled, but how quickly might they occur, or be poised to occur, based on what we observe in the world today. I actually pulled these points from an article on Life, Hope, and Truth entitled, Where Are We Now in Bible Prophecy? By Mr. Paul Lukey. The article piqued my interest, so I started digging into each point in more detail to see just how close these signs are to being fulfilled, based on what we see happening in the world. So with that, let's start by looking at the first of two signs, which we find in Daniel 12, in verse 4. It's a section of scripture near the end of a prophetic vision that Daniel has regarding the end times. Daniel 12, and verse 4. It says, but you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro. Now, traditionally in the church, we interpret running to and fro as referring to travel, transportation in the world. And we have certainly seen a staggering increase in transportation and travel in our modern age, an increase that sets it apart from any other time in history. And so the first sign we're going to look at is the increase in world travel and transportation. For thousands of years, the way people traveled by land changed very little. You know, for the majority of history, you had two options. You know, you walk on your own 2 feet, or you are carried by a horse or similar animal. Even well into the 1800s, pioneers were traveling through the Wild West using horse-drawn carriages, you know, traveling perhaps 25 miles a day for a 116-day journey from New York to San Francisco. Likewise, travel by sea changed little for thousands of years. You know, until the invention of the steam engine, ships sailed for 6 to 14 weeks to cross the Atlantic Ocean and come to the New World, all the way from London to New York. But in the past century, the rate of travel worldwide has just dwarfed that of any other time in history. Up until 2003, when it was decommissioned, the fastest passenger plane on Earth, the Concorde, would take passengers from JFK to London Heathrow in 3.5 hours. That same journey that those ships were taking in 3.5 hours, 288 times faster than those sailing ships. And even more than the speed of travel, the number of people traveling each year is staggering when you look at the numbers. Today, we have over 1 billion cars worldwide. And the amount of passengers who fly each year has surpassed 4 billion. Many shall run to and fro indeed. But even these figures may soon be old news. I'd like to ask the sound crew just to play a brief video clip now to help illustrate my point. That was a little better than me trying to describe it myself. Saw was the landing of the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket. The first stage. Elon Musk, the founder and CEO of SpaceX, among other companies, is saying his rockets, which are due to be launched in 2022, will be able to take passengers from New York to London in 29 minutes. And anywhere in the world in less than an hour. I don't know about you, but it took me 35 minutes just to drive to church today. Yeah. Looking at current data such as this, how quickly could this sign of the end time, of many will run to and fro, be fulfilled? Well, frankly, when we look at the question and we look at the verse, the phrase is not specific in the Bible. You know, many is a relative term. And running to and fro is a bit vague. But that said, when you look back at the entirety of man's history, you compare this age to any other in history, there is no other time that better reflects a massive increase in world travel and transportation than today. No other time compares. So it's entirely possible that this sign has already passed or will in the near future. Let's look back at Daniel 12:4 and read about the second sign referenced here. You're still there in Daniel 12:4. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. So the second sign we're going to analyze is the increase in man's knowledge. The increase in man's knowledge. You know, in ancient times, knowledge was often recorded in scrolls and then later in books. And these books and scrolls were collected at various intellectual centers around the world. You know, places like Athens and Rome and Baghdad and Babylon, Constantinople. Scholars would travel from around the world to study at the ancient libraries and temples found in these great cities. But none of them was larger or more famous than the Library of Alexandria, located in Egypt. Now, for centuries, the Library of Alexandria was the center of intellectual study in the Western world. You know, at its height, it's estimated to have contained as many as 400,000 scrolls. Today, The Library of Congress in Washington contains 16 million books. But this is nothing, of course, when you compare it to the internet. A major newspaper in 2015 did a study that found if you took all the information on the internet and converted it into 200-page books, the information would comprise 681 million books. 681 million books. You know, who knows how many books the internet would fill today? I mean, that statistics is almost 5 years old. When we ask ourselves how quickly this end time sign of knowledge shall increase can be fulfilled, we're in a similar situation as we were with the last sign on travel and transportation. You know, the verse isn't specific. You know, an increase is relative. But again, when we look at the increase in knowledge, there's no other time in history that even begins to compare to our modern era. You know, researchers have estimated that up until the year 1900, human knowledge doubled about every century. You know, today, our information doubles about every 12 months. And that's trending down towards 12 hours. It's growing that fast. What makes one wonder if this sign has already been fulfilled. For another sign, a third sign, the prophecy of the end times, let's turn to Matthew 24. Matthew 24 and verse 13. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. So a third sign of the end times is that the gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world. Now, along with the explosion of knowledge that we're seeing in this internet age of ours, we've also seen a rapid expansion in man's ability to communicate around the world. You know, for the bulk of human history, mankind could only communicate as fast as they could carry a letter from point A to point B. You know, today, anyone with a computer and an internet connection or even just a smartphone can video chat with someone on the opposite side of the world in seconds. Back in the 80s and 90s, when television was king for mass communication, you know, organizations had to spend millions of dollars on television broadcasting just to reach the U.S. market domestically. You know, and they do that for just a weekly broadcast. Today, individuals can record and post a video on YouTube. And that video has the potential to reach its 1.2 billion users worldwide. And it sits out there forever. They can find it and search it from then on. And all it costs is the price of a smartphone and an internet connection. It's been very interesting to me that at the same time that the Worldwide Church of God was splitting apart in the mid-90s, that the internet and all its incredible capabilities were just starting to take off. Now, at the same time that the church was rapidly shrinking, you know, and its spending capacity with tithes and offerings was likewise shrinking, the internet was making it possible to spread the gospel even further than ever before and at exponentially lower costs. You know, looking back on that, I personally don't see that as a coincidence. In addition to expanding the reach of the messages, we're also seeing a great decrease in other barriers to communication worldwide. For example, language barriers. Let's turn to Genesis. Genesis 11 and verse 5. Genesis chapter 11 and verse 5. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language. And this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down, and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. And so the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Now, since the Tower of Babel, there has been an incredible barrier to worldwide communication. You know, for the gospel to be preached in all the world, it needs to be delivered in a way in which the nations can understand it. Now, how many languages do you think that God created at the Tower of Babel? Now, I'd be interested to learn that someday, because even today, there are still almost 7,000 spoken languages remaining in the world. But that number is continually decreasing. And 1/3 of those 7,000 languages are considered endangered because only about 1,000 people or less speak them. And they're on the brink of just disappearing entirely with those people. And although there are 7,000 spoken languages in the world, 50% of the world's population can speak one of the top five, either English, Chinese, Spanish, Hindi, or French. And 90% of all people on earth can speak one of the top 20 languages as either a native or as a second language. In addition to this, technology is also helping to break down the world's language barriers. Today, there are free mobile applications, for example, Google Translate, which you can download on your phone, and they act as a translator for you. Now, I can speak one language into my phone, and it can play the same message back to me in over 100 different languages. You know, so it enables you to speak to someone with a basic level of understanding, just about anybody on earth, through your phone. With the same application, I can point my phone's camera at a menu, and it can be in a foreign language, and what I see on my phone is in English. It just translates it on the screen for you. Admittedly, the application is not 100% accurate, but it's improving almost daily because the software behind it is powered by artificial intelligence that learns from its mistakes and is constantly making improvements to its translations. So just how quickly could the gospel be spread around the world? Now, it's very difficult. Nigh impossible, really, to know just how far the gospel of the kingdom has reached already. How would we even go about tracking something like that? I'm not sure. But as with the increase in world travel and the increase in knowledge, modern technology is rapidly expanding the reach of the gospel message at an incredible pace. In just 20 years, back in 1995, the internet had 44 million users. And 20 years after that, there was 3 billion. Now today, 55% of the world has internet access, over 4 billion people almost. 80% have TV access, so these other technologies as well. And there, in addition to this, there are over 5 billion Bibles that have been printed, since 1815, I think it was. And they're in 670 languages. They have the New Testament in 1,500 languages. Now, we can't know in advance when this sign will be fulfilled, but we can say with complete confidence that we're accelerating toward that day, that time, at a rate just dwarfs all other times in history. Let's transition now to a fourth sign of the end times. Let's look again at Matthew 24, if you're still there, in verse 21, Matthew 24, 21. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. And so another sign of the end times that we'll look at is man's capability to destroy itself. Man's capability to destroy itself. On September 26th, 1983, interestingly, my anniversary date, the Soviet Union's missile attack early warning system displayed in large red letters the word launch. This meant that this early warning system was telling the officer on duty, Soviet Lieutenant Colonel Stanislav Petrov, that it could say with high reliability that an American intercontinental ballistic missile had been launched and was heading toward the Soviet Union. Initially, it was just one missile, and then another, and another, until the system reported that a total of 5 Minuteman ICBMs had been launched. Now, thankfully, despite the insistence of the computer system and military protocol, Lieutenant Colonel Petrov did not report the incoming strike, and a Soviet nuclear counterstrike was never launched, clearly. Petrov and others on his staff chose to believe that what they were seeing was a false alarm, and it was. The computer system had been tricked. It had mistaken the reflection of the sun bouncing off some clouds as a bunch of missiles, nuclear missiles. With that decision, Lieutenant Colonel Petrov prevented a nuclear war between the Soviets and the U.S. The Soviets at that time, in 1983, had 35,000 nuclear warheads, and the U.S. had 23,000. There was enough nuclear firepower between them to wipe out the entire landmass of Earth 4 times over. And this isn't even the only time in the world that we came within seconds of triggering a nuclear war. There's at least 2 other documented incidences that happened during the Cold War, similar to this one. In the last century, man obtained the ability to destroy life on Earth through the use of nuclear weapons, not to mention biological and chemical weapons. The likelihood that such weapons will actually be put to use has increased. You know, today, 9 countries have nuclear weapons, including the nations of Pakistan and India, who have been mortal enemies and have fought 4 wars with one another just in the last century alone. Israel, who's surrounded by enemy nations that have actively sought its obliteration, and North Korea, which is run by a cruel and unstable dictator. I don't think we would be too bold to say that this sign has already been fulfilled for some time now. You know, man is capable of destroying itself, but thankfully, God has prevented us from doing so thus far, and will prevent us from doing so in the future as well. For the next prophetic event, let's look at a verse in Revelation. Let's turn to Revelation 9. Here in Revelation 9, which describes an event near the end of the Great Tribulation during the 6th trumpet. Revelation 9 and verse 13. Then the 6th angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the 4 horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the 6th angel who had the trumpet, "Release the 4 angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates." So the 4 angels who had been prepared for the hour and day and month and year were released to kill a third of mankind. Now the number of the army of the horsemen was 200 million. I heard the number of them. So a 5th sign we'll look at of the end times is the ability for mankind to field an army of 200 million. The ability for mankind to field an army of 200 million. Now, when you first dig into this and research modern armies, the sum of 200 million sounds kind of crazy. Sounds pretty far out there. Currently, the largest military in the world is China's, with an estimated 2.2 million soldiers, a mere 1% of that 200 million man army. But China is currently on a peace footing, as is the vast majority of the world and their armies. They're not mobilized for war. And so to get more accurate estimates as to how large a nation's army could be in a future time of war, let's look at how large armies were in the past, when nations focused all their efforts on waging war, such as when they were during World War II. During World War II, the average great power nation, including the USA, China, Russia, France, Germany, all these nations had between 8 to 22% of their population in active military service. And so for the sake of our estimates, let's just average that to a nice number like 15%. China's current population is about 1.4 billion people. 15% of its population was in active military service, they would have an army of 210 million people by themselves. That's just China. And the Bible never says here in these verses we read how many countries will contribute to that 200 million man army. It could be a coalition. For example, if you add India to that mix, they have 1.36 billion people. And they could also field a 200 million man army on their own based on that 15% estimate. So how fast could this sign be fulfilled? In World War II, most of the great powers were able to fully mobilize to go from a peace footing with their armies and grow them in about 1 to 3 years. That said, we need to remember when we look at this verse that the 200 million man army doesn't come until the sixth trumpet. It's potentially well into the 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation already by the time of the sixth trumpet. So in other words, the 200 million man army may not even need to begin mobilizing until after the Great Tribulation has already begun, based on those estimates. Based on how things have gone historically, it would appear that mankind already has the capability to field a 200 million man army. Let's turn to the book of Daniel. We'll look at another very important sign of the end times, Daniel 12. We'll start reading in verse 8. Daniel 12, verse 8. Although I heard, I did not understand. Then I said, "My Lord, what shall be the end of these things?" And he said, "Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed to the time of the end. Many shall be purified, made white and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away, the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he who waits and comes to 1,335 days. A sixth sign of the end times that we'll cover today is the return of the daily sacrifices in Jerusalem. The return of the daily sacrifices in Jerusalem. For this passage in Daniel to be fulfilled, the daily sacrifices first must be reinstituted. You can't take something away that doesn't currently exist. And so first they have to begin again. The Levitical priesthood hasn't been able to conduct the daily sacrifices in Jerusalem since the Second Temple was destroyed, by the Romans nearly 2,000 years ago. The Jews haven't even possessed the old city of Jerusalem until 1967. But now, in our time, there's again a nation of Israel that controls the Temple Mount. and this sign of the end times, which must have seemed like such a pipe dream for so many centuries, could be fulfilled in our lifetime, potentially. Let's start digging into this sign a little bit by looking at the book of Ezra. Let's go to Ezra chapter 3 and verse 1. Ezra 3 and verse 1. And when the seventh month had come, and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered together as one man to Jerusalem. And Jeshua the son of Jozadak, and his brethren the priests, and Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, and his brethren, arose and built the altar of the God of Israel, to offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. Skipping down to verse 6. From the first day of the seventh month they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, although the foundation of the temple of the Lord had not been laid. After the first temple, Solomon's temple, was destroyed by the Babylonians, Ezra returned with the Jewish exiles to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. But even before they laid the foundation of the new temple, they were allowed to set up the altar and reinstitute the daily sacrifice. So we see that for the daily sacrifices to be reinstituted in Jerusalem, a new temple doesn't need to be rebuilt, just the altar. How quickly could that happen? A couple years back, I gave a message on the Temple Institute. The Temple Institute is a nonprofit, educational, and religious organization that's located in the Jewish quarter of Old Jerusalem. For 30 years, the Temple Institute has been diligently working toward the creation of the third temple of God on the Temple Mount. They've been carefully researching the requirements for the construction of the temple and all the related structures and articles needed for its service, and even training a new priesthood to minister in the temple. In 2017, Jan and I toured the Temple Institute in Jerusalem, and we were just amazed to see everything that they had already created for the priesthood to minister in the temple. Now, to date, they have completed dozens of the sacred articles that are described in the Bible. You know, the articles, the garments, and tools needed to perform the different services of the temple. And among these sacred articles is a fully reconstructed altar for the daily sacrifices. An altar that stands in Jerusalem, a mere 7-minute walk from the Temple Mount. An altar that was specifically built so that it could be disassembled quickly, transported, and reassembled at another location. And with enough people and minimal equipment, I don't doubt that this altar could be set up on the Temple Mount in a matter of hours when the time is right. Well, mere hours after the conditions are right, there could be an altar standing on the Temple Mount. But despite this, the Temple Institute still lacks at least one important thing before they can institute the daily sacrifices. And that's the water of purification, which must be used to purify the priests before they can perform the daily sacrifices. Let's look into that a little bit. We'll turn to Numbers 19 and verse 2. Numbers 19 and verse 2, and we'll get a little background on how God instructed this water to be procured. Numbers 19 details the Levitical rituals for purification, and we'll just focus on a few of the more pertinent portions of it. Numbers 19 and verse 2. This is the ordinance of the law, which the Lord has commanded, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, that they bring you a red heifer without blemish, in which there is no defect, and on which a yoke has never come, You shall give it to Eleazar the priest, that he may take it outside the camp, and it shall be slaughtered before him. And Eleazar the priest shall take some of its blood with his finger and sprinkle some of its blood 7 times directly in front of the tabernacle of meeting. And the heifer shall be burned in his sight. Its hide, its flesh, its blood, and its offal shall be burned. Jumping to verse 9. Then a man who is clean shall gather up the ashes of the heifer and store them outside the camp in a clean place, and they shall be kept for the congregation of the children of Israel for the water of purification. It is for purifying from sin. And it's jumping down to verse 20. But the man who is unclean and does not purify himself, that person shall be cut off from among the assembly, because he has defiled the sanctuary of the Lord. The water of purification has not been sprinkled on him. He is unclean. The Temple Institute is looking for these ashes of an unblemished red heifer to create the water of purification, which is necessary to sanctify the priesthood according to these verses that we just read. Without this water, the priests continually remain unclean and are not permitted to offer the daily sacrifices. And this is why the Temple Institute is actively trying to breed an unblemished red heifer in Israel. You may recall from that same message I delivered a couple years ago that the Temple Institute actually created a crowdfunding page on Indiegogo, I believe it was, to gather funds through crowdsourcing to raise a red heifer in Israel. You know, since these types of cow can no longer be found within that area. Today, those funding efforts have actually borne fruit, and the Temple Institute currently has 2 calves that were born in Israel, which they claim meet the criteria described in Numbers 19. If these 2 red calves remain unblemished until their 2nd birthday, the Temple Institute will consider them old enough to be considered a heifer and not a half, or a calf, excuse me, a heifer being an unbred female cow. So at that 2-year-old birthday, they will consider it a heifer, and then it will be ready for that sacrifice. So how fast could the daily sacrifices begin based on that information? Based on these assumptions and time frames, the earliest the daily sacrifice could be reinstituted would be August of 2020, next year, based on these assumptions. Let's turn to the book of Luke, and we'll look at one last sign that we'll discuss today. Luke 21. Luke 21 is the parallel account of the Olivet prophecy that we read about in Matthew 24 and also in Mark 13. But instead of referring to the abomination of desolation as the trigger for the great tribulation, as it does in Matthew 24 and Mark 13, Luke 21 refers to a different event that happens at that time. So we'll look at Luke 21 in verse 20. Luke 21, verse 20. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then you know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart. And let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant, to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. And they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And so a final sign that we'll look at today is the capture of Jerusalem by a Gentile army. Capture of Jerusalem by a Gentile army. Even just this month, here in March of 2019, hundreds of Palestinians rioted at the Temple Mount. Some even threw firebombs at police stations and security vehicles. Now, Israel responded by temporarily locking down the Temple Mount and arresting rioters. And in response to this, Israel received violent threats and demands from the Palestinian organizations and Hamas, and condemnation from various Muslim countries. As of today, the issue is still unresolved as Israel works with Jordan and the Palestinians to calm the situation. But what caused these latest acts of violence and escalations? Well, the cause was that the Israelis refused to allow a mosque to be reopened on the Temple Mount, a mosque that had been closed to worship since 2003. Riots and deadly violence broke out because a mosque remained closed. If that's the response to that, what would the response be to a closing of the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the Temple Mount or the Dome of the Rock? What if the Muslims weren't allowed on the Temple Mount at all? What if Israel locked it down? What if either of these buildings were damaged or destroyed? What would the response be if the Jews placed an altar on the Temple Mount and reinstituted the daily sacrifices? I don't think it's far-fetched to think personally that such an act could trigger war. Israel is a tiny nation, the size of New Jersey, surrounded by enemies, many of them committed to the nation's destruction. Now, all of whom have fought wars with Israel multiple times in recent history. Armies from Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, all of these could cross the border and surround Jerusalem in a matter of hours, not days. How quickly could these end times signs and prophecies be fulfilled? How quickly? On that fateful night when the Titanic sunk, it was clear and calm, with the sky filled with the brightest stars the observers had ever seen. On a night such as that, it was believed that the two lookouts in the crow's nest should have seen any iceberg 30 minutes before the ship ever collided with it. But the watchmen didn't spot the iceberg until they were a mere 30 seconds from impact. Titanic's lookouts remarked in their account of the collision that there was a strange mirrored haze around the horizon. Now, despite the remarkable clarity of the star-filled night sky, and they testify that the fatal iceberg appeared out of this haze at the last moment. It's been years since I've been on a road trip. You know, I took a lot of them growing up, you know, well into my teen and college years, but it's probably been well over a decade, I think, since I've really done a road trip. And one of my most memorable road trips is one that we took out west to the Grand Teton National Park. We used to have a teen challenger camp out there, you might remember, and Jan and I and a bunch of other teens had all piled into a big van to attend it. But I remember on this trip seeing a really fascinating phenomenon. It was a clear and calm day, you know, not a cloud in the bright blue sky. And looking down that road to Wyoming, that long, flat, straight road, I could see in the distance what looked like this thick, reflective haze, which had formed just parallel to the horizon. We never got any closer to the haze as we drove. It just seemed to hover there in the distance. And it kind of sort of shimmered there like water on the horizon almost. And then I saw a car materialize out of this haze and came toward us and just passed right by. It's like it drove through a thick, watery curtain. And then I saw a semi do the same thing, and another car, and another car. It was a really fascinating thing to see. Perhaps you've experienced a similar phenomenon yourself. When a mass of cold air collides with a mass of warm air, it can cause light where the air masses collide to bend and refract at different angles, which can create this hazy reflective curtain, like a false horizon. which is what I must have seen on my road trip to Wyoming. And a false horizon that can hide things from view behind a mirage of refracted light. It's this phenomena that scientists now conclude caused the sinking of the Titanic. Tim Moulton is a British historian and a preeminent expert on the sinking of the Titanic. After rigorous analysis of the many eyewitness accounts, the weather reports for that day, and ship's logs, Mr. Moulton discovered that at the time of the impact, Titanic was sailing across a boundary between the freezing cold current of the Labrador Sea and the warm current of the Gulf Stream. He concludes that it was at this point where an immense false horizon was created that was large enough to hide the deadly iceberg in Titanic's path until it was too late. Both lookouts actually survived the sinking of the Titanic. And in their account, and that of many other eyewitnesses, they describe the telltale signs of a false horizon. The clear moonless sky, the sudden 40-degree drop in temperature, the refracting of the starlight in the distance, and the reflective haze that blurred the horizon. All the criteria needed to hide a glacier from their view until mere seconds before impact. They witnessed all the signs. They just didn't recognize what they meant or realize the imminent danger that they foretold. Let's turn to one last passage in 1 Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 1. But concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you, for you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them, as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness, so that this day should overtake you as a thief. You are all sons of light and sons of the day. We are not of the night, nor of darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as others do, but let us watch and be sober. For those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who get drunk are drunk at night. But let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet the hope of salvation. For God did not appoint us to wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, that whether we wake or sleep, we should live together with him. Brethren, this world doesn't know the disaster that lays in its path, and it won't recognize the telltale signs when they appear. The end times will not be a glacier that they spot 30 minutes from impact, but will emerge seemingly out of nowhere to those who won't recognize the signs for what they truly are. But our eyes need not be clouded. The Bible tells us that we need to be what we need to be on the lookout for. It equips us with the information we need to discern the times and the seasons of the end of this age. So let us be sober. Let us be vigilant. For the end times are closer than ever before, and our hope and salvation come swiftly on its heels. And may God prepare us well and count us all worthy when that day comes.